listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief.
Sorry, when you work with nonprofit, you know, you have to play several roles at the same time. So about dialogue. So one of the leading goals in Muslimish is to facilitate a safe environment for dialogue. If you look at the Muslimish goals, they're very simple, specific goals, and one of them is to create, and the first and utmost one is to create a safe environment for dialogue, something that might seem simple to us, we might enjoy here, we might take for granted, but in many parts of the world, in many communities, even within the free world, even within societies that celebrate the freedom of expression, nevertheless, you can prevent governments and the authority of the government to interfere with free speech, but you cannot prevent the authority of a society and a community to limit and prevent free speech. So if the Constitution guarantees your free speech, it doesn't mean that society will abide. The government you can force it through an independent judicial system to follow this set of rules, but how can you force a society? You can only do that through education. The single greatest problem in communication is the illusion that it had taken place. You won't talk to a person ever that he'll tell you, I'm close to dialogue. I'm not open to have a discussion. Everyone thinks that they're open to dialogue, they're open to discussion. But how does that take place? Ironically, this channel is called the Democratic Channel. And the word democracy in Arabic is written right under that platform. Dialogue is the free exchange of meaning between two or more people. There is what we are going through today, and I know Ali Rizvi is going to reflect more in depth on that, is I think that the internet has speeded up things in the especially I'm going to reflect a little bit more in the Islamic world, have speeded up things in the Islamic world to facilitate dialogue, something that sometimes have been muffled by politics, sometimes muffled by religious institutions, by different factors. Now the internet has changed the conversation, and it's no longer escapable, it's no longer avoidable. Our websites, whether it is, I'm involved with some reform Islamic movements, our websites, whether it's Islamic reform or our Muslimish websites, they are censored in many of the countries in the Middle East. Some of my friends who I asked them to check out if it's censored or not in some areas, they're even afraid to check. They're even afraid even to search for it. The internet, though, has changed the conversation nevertheless. You'll find books that are, for example, like The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, translated to every language in the Middle East, in Persian, in Arabic, and it's shared through WhatsApp, through a PDF text message, the whole book is shared. The Middle East is actually 64.5% has an internet penetration. Facebook is very, very popular in the Middle East, has been on the growth. It actually went up by 264% since 2012 in the Middle East and North Africa. One of the tools, and anyone who's has friends from the Middle East, they know that the number one tool used is WhatsApp. And this, it really makes me crazy. I don't know how they use WhatsApp as a social media app. It is like the worst. I have a social media marketing company, and I don't understand how WhatsApp, how a text messaging service can be used as social media. You cannot track. You cannot, there's no post. There's no, but it is heavily used. People receive hundreds of messages that are, you know, broadcast. They have a broadcast feature, WhatsApp, where you can have a list of 250 people where you broadcast to, not as a group, but as a, you know, just individuals. And this is used heavily. This is one of the largest tools. It is the single largest tool of communication in the Middle East. 97% in Lebanon, 100% in UAE. It is number one and used in the Middle East. It's not the best for systematic content, but it is the best for viral content. So this has facilitated dialogue. What are the challenges of dialogue that you can have in any place? Since we are about dialogue, what are the challenges? And then I'm going to talk about some of the points how we face these challenges. So first of all, there is the biological challenge. Biology always wins. The scientists have indicated the correlation in the brain between a physical threat and what is perceived as a threat in a dialogue. The brain kind of acts the same way. There is a response biologically. And when you're having a dialogue with someone, you want to avoid that biological trap. You want to avoid it in yourself, watching yourself and your reaction, and also avoid putting that opposite party in a position where they feel threatened. Conspiracy theory. The problem in the Middle East, conspiracy theory is mainstream. So the minority only don't believe in conspiracy theory. Sometimes it's so mainstream that thinking the opposite way puts you in an embarrassing situation. Like, really, you believe that? Nobody believes that anymore. Oh, evolution? This has been dismissed long time ago. What are you talking about? So lack of prerequisite knowledge. When we're having a conversation and there is so much preliminary knowledge in the conversation that is not agreed upon, then we're running around ourselves. So how can you have a debate? I've seen a show once where they had a debate about evolution with a geologist, an Islamic geologist. How can an Islamic geologist have a debate about a biological subject? I know geology is involved with it, but it's not his specialty. So there are some... Or an imam speaking about evolution. This needs a lot of academic training before you can speak about it. Actually, part of the reason I have gone through an intellectual transformation is because in the Islamic, as a chairman of an Islamic organization, we had an office of jurisprudence, and we received a question. It was at the same time where Lucy was discovered. It was discovered earlier, but the research came out in 2007, 2008. So we received a question, and I took the question to the jurisprudence office, and the jurisprudence office didn't know. I mean, this is not, there's no academic training in most of the Islamic institutions. So you won't find an expert biologist like something like a Catholic Church would have, experts in certain fields of sciences. But that's not common in Islamic organizations. Al-Azhar has some academic training, but not to the extent of international recognition or expertship. So I was really stuck. How can I answer this question? It was asked by an engineer. We need to produce something, and we are considered like a progressive Islamic movement. We want to produce. And it took me 8 months doing research on the subject to answer the question. And the more research I made, I'm myself trained in software engineering, so I'm also not trained in biology. The more training, the more reading I've done about the subject, the more studying of the subject, the more I discovered how much I don't know about the subject. Before that, I had certainty that, oh, this is something, you know, I understand it. It's 1, 2, 3. Man came from monkeys, and it has been disproven. It's done. And the more I learned, the more I learned how ignorant I was and how much I have no idea about what I'm talking about. And I was writing an article, it's called Islam and Evolution, and I published the first part, and the more I studied, it started deconstructing my understanding of life. And we're close to the University of Michigan, and I've relied on discussions with some of its professors to have a deeper understanding. I just could not find a solution, and it caused me to change the model of life as I understand it. So prerequisite knowledge, closed-mindedness. I need someone to watch time for me. Maybe Ibrahim, just make some signs for me or scare me. Closed-mindedness, animosity or distrust. You cannot have a dialogue with an enemy if you perceive them as an enemy. You cannot distrust someone, distrust their motives, and have a dialogue with them. That undermines dialogue from the beginning. And some attempts of dialogue within our Islamic world has these elements within them. You cannot have that dialogue happen. It's against the definition of dialogue. Or authoritarianism. You cannot have a person with an authority, like let's say in a classroom, a teacher debate with a student. There is an unequal balance of power. Strong emotions undermine dialogue. Packaging ideas together. When we're speaking about something, don't bring other subjects to it and then try to package them together and dismiss the whole conversation. We need to stick to one subject at a time and only discuss it. Security concerns. So if a person is threatened with his security, how can he have debate? I have two videos to show you as an example of what I'm talking about. Before that, it was unfathomable to have such dialogues. Now they're taking place. They don't look good, but it's a start. And I'm going to show you some examples. Fear turns dialogue into silence, into violence, into masking. And how we face these challenges, establishing a mutual purpose. This is some of the requirements for having a dialogue. Dialogue is not a debate. Dialogue is not that I'm going to make you think like me or you're going to make me think like you. It is an exchange of ideas. We're putting all our ideas in a pool to increase our overall pool of knowledge. So it is not threatening. I'm not trying to change anything. I'm trying to increase knowledge. Now, knowledge might indirectly change things. That's great. That's what's the purpose of knowledge. Ensuring relaxed and safe environment. Nobody is there to win. Everyone is there to learn. It's very important to establish these purposes in a dialogue, to always go back to them. What do we want here? We want to reach that. It has to be a common purpose. If it's different purpose, it's not dialogue. Introducing all parties and their motives. You have to know who I am before we have a dialogue. Starting with the prerequisite knowledge. If there is prerequisite knowledge that we need, we have to start with that. And that makes the process of dialogue long. It's a process. It's not a one-time Ahmed Didat versus Jimmy's Swaggart debate that was broadcast to the whole world. Like, now we're going to see Christianity or Islam is going to win. This never works. We had a big debate in Dearborn between one of the atheist community and Imam. It was held in Dearborn, where there's a high concentration of Muslims. 90% of the audience were from the Muslim community. And the cheering, it was like a boxing match. And I don't think people understood what anyone is saying. It was just, we're waiting for the next strike so we can, feel that we're winning. Avoiding control, labeling, or personal attacks. Controlling the conversation, controlling the dialogue. That should be avoided. Showing empathy and understanding with the other party. Our beliefs are part of our emotions. They're inseparable. So we have to dwell carefully. Ideas are not separate from emotions except in books. So we have to, when we're dealing with humans, we have to humanize the subject of dialogue. The human that I'm discussing with is more important than the ideas that he believes in. So I have to preserve him as a human, his humanity. I have to care about his feelings. At the same time, be honest about the ideas that I'm discussing. So it's a balance, which I'm going to talk about in a second. Prioritizing and pragmatism. There are priorities in dialogue. For example, if there are questions about the historicity of Prophet Muhammad, was he there or not there? That's not a priority to other subjects. So I have to pick and choose what subjects I want to have a dialogue about. Things that are not a priority, they're an intellectual luxury, should be delayed for other subjects that are actually affecting lives as we speak. I'm sure that there's someone in prison in every capital of the Islamic world because of freedom of speech issues. So there are more pressing subjects to speak about, so we should leave luxurious. I'm not downplaying them, they're important, but we should prioritize. And removing fear. If I'm having a discussion and someone has a fear because they're afraid of the vacuum of losing some of their belief, they're afraid that they always had hope to see their dead grandparents one day again, and I'm removing that hope. These fears we have to recognize. And I have to deal with that fear before I go on with the dialogue. Otherwise, I'm dealing with fear. Fear is the basis of most of our human actions. If you're not removing fear, you cannot change action. I'm going to talk about the Quran, the dialogue in the Quran. So there are verses in the Quran that are pro-dialogue, and there are verses that are anti-dialogue. And how can we look at both these? So really fast. It seems that more the Meccan Quran, the Quran before the migration of the Prophet, was more into dialogue. It had more a positive attitude towards other books. Of course, dialogue in the sense of let us teach you, let's have a dialogue and let us teach you and try to shed light on the truth for you. So who provides for you from the heavens and the earth? Say Allah, and indeed, we or you are either upon guidance or in clear error. I consider this to be the most open-minded verse in the Quran. Inna aw iyyakum la'ala hudan aw fi dhalalin mubin. It's either or you are guided or in error. It's telling the Prophet to say that I'm either wrong or I'm right. I feel that was the best concession given in a verse in the Quran. It's in Surah Nuh. In Mecca. Kalimatin Sawa, this is one of the symbolic verses in the Quran. Say, people of the book, let us arrive at a common statement. The use of the common statement, very important concept. Do not argue except only in the best way with the people of the book. This is instructions to Muslims that do not have arguments unless it is in the best way. There's many interpretations what does the Quran mean by the best way. And there is a couple exceptions there, those who act unjustly, and the best way dilemma. You know, Prophet never had a dialogue with the people of the book, so we don't really know what he means by these conditions, but it is nevertheless stated that it has to be a positive conversation. People who created, we created all of you from man and woman and made you into races and tribes so that you should get to know one another. This is recognizing diversity and establishing merit based on faith and piety. Now it's a step away. It's kind of demolishes feudalism, demolishes racism in one way, but it establishes that merit based on faith, which can also hurt in another way. It's not a blanket merit based on humanity. It's merit based on faith, which allows for the dehumanization of a person without faith, which is a downfall of Islam in another way. And then there are other verses that establishes the normalization of differences, that if God wanted to create all of you as one people, we would have done it. But we have created you different. So these are positive verses that allow for dialogue in Islam. And then you have some anti, and the whole Quran is a dialogue. Most of the Quran is a dialogue. But we're picking some verses that tells you about some of the anti and some of the pro dialogue. So this one, the believers should not make the unbelievers their allies. Rather, this is the prohibition of alliance with non-believers. In Surah Ali Imran 328, one of the important surahs that tackle the issue of the people of the book, one of the also biggest chapters in the Quran. So it prohibits alliances with non-believers. The word al-wala, alliance, some of them extend it more. They say even friendship. Some of them they say, no, it means more like political alliance. So it goes, there's a spectrum of meaning. But nevertheless, it's a negative value against dialogue. You who believe, do not take the Jews and Christians as allies. They are allies only to each other. Anyone who takes them as an ally becomes one of them. God does not guide such wrongdoers. This was revealed late in Medina after the clash between Islam and Judaism. And it is a very strong verse against dialogue. And this verse, I think this verse is the strongest verse against dialogue. It's used heavily by extremists. And it says the Jews and the Christians will never be pleased with you. لَن تَرْضَ عَنْكَ الْيَهُودُ وَلَا النَّصَارَى. The word never that is used in Arabic, it means till the day of judgment, for eternity, they will never be pleased with you. This right away undermines any effort of dialogue. What are you doing dialogue for? There is animosity till the day of judgment. Very, very strong verse that undermines dialogue. Another one is the one that actually separates between the different non-believers, the disbelievers, the people with other beliefs, and creates some sort of demonization. So you, Prophet, are sure to find that the most hostile to the believers are the Jews and those who associate with the deities with God. You are sure to find that the closest in affection towards the believers are those who say we are Christians. And of course, this was revealed also late in Medina after the clash with Judaism. Well, there was no clash with Christianity because there was no Christian tribes within Medina or Mecca. So there was no territorial fights. This is very striking to me. Like, these verses are like two sentences away from each other. One that is prohibits dialogue with, you know, it's a pro-dialogue, and one is anti-dialogue. And this is a conflict in the Quran which creates a spectrum of Islamic perspectives. For the sake of time, I'm not going to read this for you, but it's chapter Ali Imran 115, 118. One that says they're not... those are not equal. Those, you know, the pro dialogue says not all the non-believers are equal. Some of them are great, and لا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون. They will never have fear. They never have to worry. They are destined for good things. And the other one is prohibits any kind of trust given to non-believers, and they're right next to each other, and it creates inner conflicts within Muslims who have a contemplation over the Quran. This verse, for example, look at this sort of dialogue, okay? In Surah, this is in Surah Al-Kahf. The truth is from your Lord. So whoever wills, let him believe, or whoever wills, let him disbelieve. And this is usually quoted by Muslim scholars, by some apologists. مَنْ شَاءَ فَلْيُؤْمِنْ وَمَنْ شَاءَ فَلْيَكْفُرْ. Whoever can believe, or whoever can disbelieve. But if they continue reading the verse, right away after it, it says, indeed we have prepared for the wrongdoers a fire whose walls will surround them. And if they call for relief, they will be relieved with water like murky oil, which scalds their faces. Rich is the drink and evil is the resting place. One of the most terrorizing verses that you cannot even read to a child. They're given water because they're so thirsty, but the water is so hot that it melts their faces before they even drink it. And that's for those who do not believe. But, you know, you just said that, you know, you can either believe or disbelieve. So this undermines dialogue. When you're saying, let's have dialogue, but this is what's going to happen to you anyway. So it undermines dialogue. Now, modern Muslims have reinterpreted these verses. They said that what happened at that time, that religion was basically associated with political allegiances. So if you're a Christian, you belong to the Christian camp. It's like an army. If you're a Jewish, you belong to the Jewish army that's fighting Muslims. And because it was a wartime, so they're talking to them not as a religion, but as an enemy, as an army, as an opposing army. So that's one excuse. And another is that these are wartime verses, so they are circumstantial, while the other verses I read in the beginning, they are the rule. They are the more about, okay, good, we'll take it. That's great. But the next step that Muslim reformists have to do is they have to say, okay, then we need a New Testament then. If these are wartime verses, we are no longer in wartime, so let's do a New Testament and take away the things that have only historical context. This has been talked about recently. It has been vocalized. It hasn't been done yet. It's blasphemous to attempt. But I'm telling you, in our lifetime, it's going to happen. There are efforts currently taking place. So we need to be free and own your opinion to be able to give in into intellectual concession and follow convictions. And that does not present if a Muslim is doing a dialogue, but he's restricted, he or she are restricted by certain beliefs and set of rules. You know, in Islam, if you defy a verse in the Quran intentionally, then this is a reason for leaving Islam. You become an apostate by defying one clear meaning of a verse. If the verse is not clear in its meaning, then you can have ijtihad, you can have a difference in opinion. But if the verse is clear in meaning and you say no, then it is basically leaving Islam. So, and the Quran has over 6,500 verses. So now you're abided by this huge constitution, huge set of rules, and that muffles any dialogue. You cannot have a dialogue if you're not free in the journey of your mind. Now also, Reform Islam, which is still a baby and it's probably it's under like intensive care, it's saying that, you know, let's go with the mind and God will respect that, not the book. So it's a modern way of looking at it. Now, this is an example when dialogue is now taking, it's a good thing that it's starting to take place. This is a huge courage. This is the host. So this is dialogue, and that host is the facilitator of this dialogue.
What year was this?
This is recent. You notice that he's apologizing to his audience. And now this is on TV with a respected scholar from Al-Azhar, the biggest Islamic authority in the Sunni world. And imagine what this guy is going to face in the neighborhoods of Egypt. This is another example, it's shorter. This is in Lebanon. I got it. I think that's enough to show another example. These conversations would not take place previously. Now they're taking place. They're very intimidating. We need to remove a lot, everything I mentioned about the challenges of dialogue. It's going to be a long journey before dialogue itself is a goal in the Middle East. Like just reaching, forget about the results of dialogue, but reaching dialogue. And you know, historically, dialogue is a tool of knowledge. It's one of... Dialogue is synonymous to education. Without it, no dialogue is no education. Our lives begin to end the day we become silent about things that matter. Silence is very dangerous. Dialogue is not decision-making. It's very important to understand that we're not making decisions in dialogue. That's why people are threatened. The goal is not to persuade others, but to add to the pool of meaning. This is some of the words we should use in dialogue. You know what? We need to talk about this. When someone presents something that is... you feel threatened about it, or it touches one of the subjects that are close to your heart. I'm glad you asked this question. Thank you for taking that risk. I appreciate the trust. I appreciate your courage and open mind. These are words we should use in dialogue. Does anyone see it differently? I want to go to the last point, and I'm not going to talk a lot about it because I think Ali Rizvi, and it's a great, you know, intellectual parallelism that's taking place. I think Ali Rizvi is going to shine more light on it from our conversation yesterday. We have a big challenge in Muslimish, which is honest versus responsible in our dialogues. I think the next step for us as a movement is creating a symbolic, value-based, time-resistant, location-free, uniting intellectual reference. Because we need to reference something. People that we have dialogue with, they have references they point towards. We need to have a reference. And from looking at, I just finished a trip in Europe, and I've being in Boston itself is inspirational. We have seen in history the importance and effect of documents, of declarations, of statements. They might seem just words, but once they are solidified in the form of document, once you have people names inscribed on them, they grow in power, signature by signature. We have seen it with all these documents. I don't know if... Oh, it's not there. Okay, but you've seen it with the declaration of... Maybe, okay, just mirroring. It's fine. I just thought that the picture is important for referencing. Okay. The Declaration of Human Rights, the Declaration of Independence, the Magna Carta, the Constitution for the Declaration of Human Right and Citizen Right, the French, you know, the result of the French Revolution, the first and the third, the French Constitution. All these documents, they were written by thinkers who had long dialogues, and the result of these dialogues came in the form of documents. And, you know, David, in this painting of the National Convention, depicts it very beautifully. If you have, if you know the what this refers to in history is when the French delegates, they went to Versailles and the king has closed the doors. They prevented them from attending the you know, the parliamentary procedure, and they just insisted on meeting and having a declaration, where the center is the reciting of the document. It has replaced the king, it has replaced the church, it has replaced the noble class. It was replaced by a document, by the document. So I think the next effort is working on a united document that we can use as a tool to unify all the forces. That is the purposeful dialogue that we can have, is having that document that summarizes our purpose. And you're going to see more of that as we proceed. And we it's very exciting time for us because we're living that history right now. We are in the process of making that history, and you'll see it as we progress together in this effort. We'll see where this is going to take us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hussam. Courageous, important. We're so glad you could be here. We're honored to have you here to deliver this message in our community. So as you heard, or if you're coming later, the first speaker from the Muslimish organization was a co-founder of the organization who has helped to set some of the practical foundations of the organization and is now talking about the intellectual foundations of the organization as well. And we're going to hear more about the sort of documentation of the organization and its ideas. And it's also, and this is something that we've just so loved about it here at the Humanist Hub, is Muslimish is a community organization. And the next speaker, Hannah ready? Yes. Hannah is... an example of someone who is building community around these ideas, around these ideals, and around the Muslimish organization. Hannah is a Muslimish New York City co-organizer, a student of Middle Eastern Studies and Religious Studies, completing a master's degree at City College of New York City. And you grew up Christian, practiced Shia and Sunni Islam, and you're currently a teacher in an international high school. And I just want to say a little bit more than that. You'll tell your story, which is a really an interesting story that sort of brings your identity to different parts of the world in ways that we love here. But I want to say that you are somebody that found community based on this organization that people like Hussam and others began to envision and create. That in some ways, as I understand it, and, you know, I may have some of the nuances wrong, so just correct me, but as I understand it, there were people who created the Muslimish organization hoping that people like you, Hannah, would come along. And then they did, and you got involved, and you found some community there in a very meaningful way. But then the reason I say that you're not only an example of the community, but exemplary as an example, is that you didn't just come along and find the community, then you got involved and now you're helping to build the community. And for those of us, you know, and I myself was in this position one time. Once upon a time, I found a community, a humanist community that I loved, that I had been waiting for at that point my whole life. And I said, I can't believe I found this place. But I didn't stop there, and none of us, unfortunately, can afford to stop there because the community doesn't build itself. And for the people who love it, unfortunately, it doesn't exist unless we then continue to build it. And you are doing that. And I know that the founders and the other leaders of the organization are very proud of that effort that you're giving, and we're excited to have you here to tell your story. Hannah, please.
Can you guys hear me like yes. this? Okay, great. So I only have 15 minutes, and there's a lot to say, but I'm going to talk about basically, yeah, that's better. Thank you. I'm going to talk about the communities I've been a part of and how that led me to finding Muslimish, which is my home community now. So I have always known religion. I grew up in a strict Pentecostal household. And that was actually in Casper, Wyoming, very small area, a small town. And so our community was very tight. And we supported each other. You know, my mother ran the food bank. We were at church multiple times a week. And so it's what I knew. I knew community as not really just family, but the family you choose. And that was a religious family. So I did move back to Texas. I was born there. We moved back to Texas when I was young. And I got involved in the church there. I did missionary work. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail with that because I only have 14 minutes now. But I did missionary work with like smuggling Bibles into Vietnam from Cambodia, that kind of thing. But that also led me to having a lot of questions, and I wasn't satisfied with the answers I received. So I left Christianity. And at that time I identified as an agnostic. I was also very young at that time. I was 13. So I hadn't chosen a new community, but I wasn't really looking either. So to backtrack a little bit, my mother is white American, and that's how I grew up Pentecostal. But my father was from Pakistan, and I didn't actually know his family until I was almost 14. So after I had already been very involved in the church and left Christianity, I then met that family on a visit to England, where most of them live now. So, I have to kind of fast forward.
Thank you for listening to Muslimish Freethinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/Muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at Muslimish.org.